You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the hunt is on for a cure for autoimmune diseases. Together, they affect 1 in 5 Americans. They're much more common among women. Find out what we do know and what we don't know about autoimmune diseases today at 6 on 1A+. Now, your name could say a lot about you. It might carry your reputation, your identity as an individual. You might be named after someone and feel that deeper connection to them. Your last name might say something about your family, maybe where your ancestors came from. Or you might change your name legally or informally in daily use to better reflect who you see yourself as, the perception you want to give off. Historically, name changes were often a way to avoid discrimination, but over time, people's motivations for changing their names have also shifted. Our next guest has spent more than a decade researching name changes and ethnic identity to understand what our names say about us and why we might change them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your name for one reason or another, first and or last, legally or just, you know, what people call you in person? Why did you want to change it? And do you know the story of your family's last name? Was it changed maybe in the early days of immigration? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kirsten Vermeiglisch is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, where she researches the historical meanings and nature of ethnic identity. She's the author of several books. Her most recent is called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your inviting me to be on this.
Now, you did some fascinating research for that book I mentioned. You look back now in New York, where so many immigrants started their experience in the United States, going back, looking over name-changing petitions in the U.S. for decades and decades. What inspired you to dig into those?
Oh, well, I usually say to people as a joke that when you have a name like Kirsten Vermeiglisch, of course you're going to be interested in name changing.
The ferrets of the world, by the way, but I stuck with it.
Yeah, no, and we actually have family members who've changed their names even more, and there's a whole firm part of my family. I never changed my name. The name did used to be something long, slightly different, but it wasn't really. I mean, that played a role in it. I think I've always found names fascinating, but I'm also a scholar of American Jewish history and American history. And I have always been really interested in sort of the ways that people kind of use names to try to identify, particularly who's Jewish, you know, sort of ideas about sort of what a Jewish name is. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting place to go to kind of think about how people have defined their ethnic community and thought about who is and who's not in the community.
I have this notion in my head that there are so many people who came from Eastern Europe or Italy or you name it, and they hit Ellis Island, and that Ellis Island clerk simplified or Americanized their names. And according to your research, I guess not so much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so my research, I usually sort of say that genealogists and anybody who's really looked at Ellis Island kind of knows that this isn't the case, that it certainly was not a wide scale phenomenon. There's no evidence of it. If you look sometimes, I mean, it's hard to do this on the radio. I sometimes will do this visually. If you look at manifests, which people listening to the show might have done genealogy, and they might have looked at the ship manifest, where their ancestors came in. And if you look closely at those, you'll see little check marks. People at Ellis Island, the officials at Ellis Island actually didn't take record. They didn't actually write down anybody's name. They actually checked your name against your ship manifest. And there were actually rules at Ellis Island saying you could not change a name. And in fact, American law, all the states in the United States are actually very flexible in their naming, in the ability to change your name. So even if an Ellis Island official did change your name, you could just change it back really easily and quickly and unofficially. So usually, I and other scholars kind of want to emphasize that probably your name was not changed at Ellis Island, even though I know that's really disappointing and upsetting for people who've heard that story from families. And instead, what I found in my research is actually, if you look at name change petitions, so many people actually chose to change their names.
Let's talk about that. And in your research, you found that recent Jewish immigrants, or maybe even not so recent, changed their names, not just because they wanted to sound more American, but for very specific reasons, discrimination. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, and I, when I went into my research, I really didn't know what to find. Really, nobody else has done this research before me. There's very little research into name changing. So I really didn't know what to expect. And I was really, really surprised to see, I mean, my first experience in walking into the archive the first day, I walked actually into the courthouse, and they just showed me into this little tiny room that just had wall-to-wall boxes of name change petitions, and like huge numbers of them were all 1930s and 1940s, especially, just boxes and boxes. So not during an era of major immigration. And instead, sort of the largest numbers came in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, after immigration had actually slowed to a trickle. And so what was really interesting to see, so that was one thing that really surprised me. And the other thing that I hadn't really expected was how many Jewish surnames were being changed. Predominantly surnames, some first names too, but predominantly surnames. And it really matches up with the institution and sort of the spiraling of institutionalized anti-Semitism in the United States, which really rose in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. And so I think it's really significant that all these Jews are changing their names at this time when they pay a penalty for having Jewish surnames or Jewish names at all. People sort of identify them and then won't give them jobs, won't let them into schools. And so I think that that was really significant that at that time, as people are experiencing this kind of discrimination, they're choosing to erase these names that kind of made them targets.
Talking to historian Kirsten Vermeiglisch from Michigan State University, looking at the history of name changes in the United States, why we change our names and how that changes over history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story maybe about the evolution of a name in your family, an official name change, or how the pronunciation maybe changed over the years? Have you changed your name for some reason? What led to that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, I imagine this must be an ambivalent moment for a lot of people historically. They would like to not be discriminated against. They'd like to get that job. So there's that incentive to change a name, but they might feel like, hey, what about this connection with, you know, my family and all of its history?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, what I wound up finding was a lot of both about sort of family history, but also about how people felt in the moment, their communities, right? So what I think a lot of people hadn't really looked at before, and what I think that I was able to find in my research, was that certainly in the Jewish community, there was a lot of ambivalence and actually kind of anger and frustration with Jewish name changers, especially after World War II. You know, after the Holocaust, there was a great deal of kind of frustration and anger even directed at people who had changed their names. So people who changed their names reported being made fun of by members of their community. I found a petition of a man who had changed his name, and when he wanted to get married, the family he was marrying into made him change his name back. They refused to allow their daughter to get married to the changed name. So there was a lot of, and there were a lot of movies and books and other kinds of cultural artifacts that, you know, sort of made fun of name changers or kind of made them the villains in the stories. I think there was a lot of, and a lot of kind of family disquiet. You know, I interviewed a few people who talked about sort of anger and frustration, or just unhappiness that they had this name that had been changed and they hadn't known about it, you know, family secrets and things like that. So yeah, I think that it led to, I think, some disruption and really sort of pointed to some fissures within the Jewish community as people had different responses to anti-Semitism. They had different responses to sort of how to deal with the discrimination they were facing.
In that time period, did you see other communities seeing similar waves of name changes? I think in pop culture of the Untouchables movie, where a Giuseppe Petri becomes George Stone, was this happening with non-Jewish groups in New York?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as I say, when I started doing the project, I actually thought I was going to see people of all groups changing their names. Maybe I didn't say that, but I should have. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be overwhelmingly Jews. And I most certainly did see Italians and Poles. I mean, it's New York, so it was inflected by the groups that are there. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, smaller numbers of people with Polish surnames. But I absolutely did see those. You know, one reason certainly there were many more Jews than there were those groups. And I think one reason for that is probably the kinds of jobs that Jews were looking for in comparison to other ethnic groups. Jews at that time, the 1920s and the 1930s, were predominantly looking for white or pink collar jobs. So clerks, women were looking for jobs as secretaries. And for a lot of other ethnic groups, Italians and Greeks, they might not have been looking for those kinds of jobs. Women would frequently stay outside of the paid workforce. Men were frequently looking for more working class jobs, maybe longshoremen jobs, union jobs. And those were jobs that at that time, you didn't need to fill out an application form. It's kind of weird to think about at this moment, but like the filling out of an application form and the way that your name might attract attention was really significant at this time in history. So Italians who might have changed their names, Poles who might have changed their names, they might not have felt that they needed to do so kind of legally and formally using these name change petitions. If they were looking for working class jobs, they might have gone to like another union member, right? And been like, you know, can you find me a job at the factory? Or they might have found a job by standing on a street corner, right? And, you know, sort of getting a job. Domestic servants might have found a job that way. So Jews, both because they're experiencing more discrimination and also because they're looking for white collar work, where they have to put their names down on a form in a way that other groups aren't. So I absolutely see, and this is not to say that I think other groups were absolutely changing their names, but maybe not in so many numbers because they're not facing the same kinds of, you know, this rise of anti-Semitism, but also because they're looking for different kinds of jobs. And so they show up in the economy in different ways, and their names aren't necessarily attracting the same kinds of negative attention that Jews are at that time.
Let's bring on a caller. Kristen is with us in Middleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm trying to mess with the phone here. I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father had always told me, oh, we go way back in the history of Detroit, back to the 1700s, but our name was not always Hall. It was some French name. And as I got into genealogy, it's my brick wall. I didn't know where to go with that. And with the help of some angels and some help, I finally found out what our French name was. And in Canada, the name was Michel Batry. But when they would cross the border, across the river into Detroit, because of the discrimination, they would use their stepfather's name. Back in 1803, the Batry wife married a man named Benjamin Hall. Uh-huh. So when they crossed to Detroit, they became Hall. They go back to the Windsor area, and they were Batry. So back and forth with baptismal papers over there was Batry.
Wow. But Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing that, and I'm glad you solved that mystery. Kirsten, I don't know if you have a lot of Quebecois people showing up to your records in New York, but that kind of back home, we're still old name. Over here, we are new name, I guess, probably didn't just happen in Detroit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a super fascinating story. Thank you so much for calling in. And it really does sort of show, I think, the significance of discrimination. I think so much of name changing, people sort of generally say, oh, people wanted to Americanize. But I think really thinking about the impact of discrimination on groups and the reasons, very practical reasons that people want to change names, I think that's a super important part of that story. And I think also another important part of that story is, yeah, wanting to keep connections to family families, right? People don't necessarily always want to just be remaking themselves and erasing their older family connections. They want to maintain those connections a lot of times. And so name changes is sometimes something that people see as very practical. And yeah, I mean, definitely there are super, definitely I found stories in New York of people who might have come and found, say, that their family members are using a different name, right? Their families have taken on a different name and maybe they're living with that family, or their family has convinced them that this is, you know, a good name to take on in the United States. Or they may themselves be experiencing discrimination, or they may feel that sort of to, you know, sort of present a level of kind of middle class respectability, right? If everybody in the family has that name, that it might be embarrassing for one last person not to have changed their name. So I think that there was some pressure there for people to take on the name that you know, other people had already taken on. So I think all of those kinds of factors play a role. I'm really so glad that you were able to find that too. I certainly talked to a lot of people who do genealogy and they can't figure out right. Where it came from. That's wonderful that you were able to find that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kristen. We're talking to Michigan State University history and Jewish studies professor Kirsten Vermeiglich about why we change our names, how our names shape our identities, historical trends in why and when people change their names. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your name change in your family's history, your last name? Have you changed your name? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kirsten Vermeiglich. She researches ethnic identity as a professor of history at Michigan State University. She's with us today talking about the role our names play in our identities and why people change their names and why those reasons have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, the reason people have changed their names has changed over time. You followed other ethnic groups at different points in history. What kind of things have stood out to you?
Well, I much of the work, I mean, certainly, and guided by what I saw in the archive, there was definitely this sort of phenomenon of Jews changing their names, say from like 1917 through the 1960s. And then Jews kind of fell out of the petitions, I think, as institutionalized anti-Semitism dropped out of the workforce. I think fewer people felt that they needed to change their names. But by the 21st century, the name changes remained pretty low. But then by 2001, in the years after 9/11, I saw a huge upsurge in name changing. The population of New York City changed. Far more people of color, people of Asian background, Latino, Black, Middle Eastern, North African peoples all moved into the city. And so by the years after 2001, by the 21st century, I really saw sort of an intense flourishing of name changing from all those different groups. Some of the ones that seemed sort of interesting to me were ones, I mean, there was no one group that kind of dominated, but there were a good number of Asian Americans changing their names in ways that were in some ways similar and some ways different from what happened earlier in the 20th century. And then also the case of Muslim Americans was also in some ways similar to what happened to Jews earlier, and then in some ways really, really different and really fascinating that sort of talks differently about what discrimination looks like today for different ethnic groups and people of color.
Did that post 9/11 wave continue for a long time, or was it a brief flare up of people with, Muslim sounding names changing their name just last for a couple years?
Yeah, no, I initially stopped my research I thought I would just stop with the 20th century. And then people said to me, you should really go look and see what happened after 9/11 to people with Muslim sounding and North African sounding names. And so I did. And I was really struck to see that in the years right after 9/11, that, you know, there was an upsurge in name changing among people who had names that sounded Muslim, people with names like Muhammad, people who had names like Osama, people with those kinds of names were changing their names in similar numbers, with a lot of the reasoning that sounded sometimes more explicit than what Jews had said earlier in the century. And sometimes that sounded exactly like what had happened earlier in the century. People worrying about not getting jobs, people worrying about not being able to get into school, people worried about sort of suspicion or anger or being embarrassed in front of, you know, other people. I mean, really, sometimes really heartbreaking kinds of petitions. What I found striking was that the petitions did not stay as much of an upsurge. So by 2012, 11 years after 2001, I didn't see disproportionate numbers of people with Middle Eastern or North African names changing their names.
I want to bring on one more quick call before we run out of time. Sharon is with us in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about first names being very feminine or very masculine, and that people that are transgender, changing their names, and sometimes that name change can be public. It can be a public notice, or you can have a judge that'll help you change it privately.
I gotcha, Sharon. We just have a few moments left, Kirsten, but that seems like it'd be an interesting field for future research, people who are changing gender identity and legally changing their names.
Yeah, actually, I'm just going to be publishing an article about that, actually. I think that's a fantastic point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. In addition to sort of seeing more Muslim names or more Asian American names, I actually found large numbers of people who are transgender changing their names. And New York City, actually, in terms of talking about doing it privately instead of publicly, New York City began to waive. You used to have to do it publicly, but New York City began waiving it because so many people who are transgender were afraid for their safety. And so now you can do that more privately. So that's a really important contemporary trend in name changing. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. And Kirsten, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Kirsten Vermeiglich, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, author of the book A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. She's with us today to talk about name changing, how trends in why people change their names have changed over time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Wisconsin businesses are less worried about a recession, but many owners say they're holding off on hiring. We'll get the details from a new survey of businesses in the state, find out what it all means for maybe your job. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Women's World Cup is kicking off later this week, and the U.S. team is favored, at least for now, to take home their third trophy in a row. Two sports anchors from Telemundo, Wisconsin, tell us what to watch for during the tournament. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we dig into the ongoing military budget negotiations and some hot-button issues that could lead to an unusual delay. First, the FIFA Women's World Cup kicks off this week in Australia and New Zealand. The international soccer tournament takes place every 4 years. This year, it's bigger than ever, with 32 teams playing 64 games over the course of a month. It's expected to have record-breaking viewership to see the big moments in key games.
Lavelle, Rose up the middle. Looking, cutting, shooting, go! Lavelle, 2-0 U.S.
That was UW-Madison star Rose Lavelle scoring a key goal in the 2019 World Cup. That goal helped the U.S. women's team bring home the trophy for the second time in a row. They're favorites to win again this year. If they do, they'll become the first ever three-peat champions in the history of the World Cup, men's or women's. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you planning to follow, to watch the Women's World Cup this year? Which team or teams are you rooting for? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Two Milwaukee-based sports anchors join us now for a preview of the World Cup. Alejandra Palacios is a news anchor for CBS 58 and Telemundo Wisconsin. Alejandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having us. Montse and I are really excited to be here to talk about the FIFA World Cup since we're just a few days away from it starting.
And Montse Ricosa is a bilingual news anchor for Telemundo Wisconsin and CBS 58. Montse, thanks for you. Thanks to you for joining us too.
Oh, absolutely. Like Alejandra said, we love soccer, love the World Cup, so very excited to be here today.
Now, Alejandra, the Women's World Cup hasn't been around all that long in the scope of things. Can you give us a little taste of the history?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, women have really fought so hard over the last years to just really, you know, be given that respect they need in sports, including definitely the soccer industry. So I actually want to take us back a little bit to the first soccer team that was ever created by women. It was actually founded by a group of English women. They formed the British Ladies Football Club, and they actually had their first match in 1895. So that was kind of the first big opportunity for women to be a part of soccer and participate. But unfortunately, they did face an obstacle because in 1921, the Football Association of England banned women from participating in soccer. So that ban lasted 5 decades, despite the fact that these women matches were attracting a lot of viewership, like 20 to 50,000 fans watching these games. So it's unfortunate just to hear that, you know, women started with the goal of wanting to be a part of these sports and that this opportunity was, you know, taken away from them for some decades. But then, you know, going back to the U.S., when the women's soccer really started in the 70s, that's really when women's soccer in the United States kind of began to take off. I know that in 1970, the International Women's Soccer Federation was created in Italy. It was an organization that wasn't recognized by FIFA, but that took on the task of really giving a new boost to women's soccer, which was great. And that was just kind of the first step, you know, to really getting women that attention and what they deserve to be a part of this sport. So I know that their first step was to organize an unofficial World Cup that wasn't recognized by FIFA. It was held in Italy and won by Denmark. So 7 teams participated in that tournament. And then from then on, that's really when women's soccer began to take off. In 1983, the Spanish Federation recognized its women's national team. And then from there, in 1985 was when the U.S. women's national soccer team was founded. So a lot of, you know, big points, a lot of things we had to do to kind of get to this point. So then going back to the women's first World Cup that was held in China back in 1991, where 12 teams participated. The U.S. won the first World Cup, defeating Denmark 2-1. And, you know, 5 years after that, the sport was then included in the Olympics. And then just fast forwarding to 2001, when the Women Champions League was born, which is the world's most important club level competition. So it's just amazing, again, to just see all that hard work that all these people had to do to really get us to where we are now with, you know, 32 teams competing. I mean, it's really exciting.
And Montse, I want to pick up where we are now. Can you talk about this peak and still growing popularity of the women's soccer game and especially the World Cup?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like Alejandra said, for us to get, you know, 61 years after the first men's World Cup for the woman to finally have it, I think the U.S. women's national team is really what a lot of people are watching for. You know, we've had the battle with equal pay for women, and that finally has been overcome just recently, where women were alleging the U.S. women's team that they were consistently getting paid less than their male counterparts by thousands of dollars at each level of competition. The lawsuit was finally ended in 2022. And I think now women really have the opportunity where we're seeing that the fastest growing major team sport is soccer right now. Women are being seen in soccer and in basketball, and we can talk about that later too. But I think just women's sports in general are finally getting the spotlight that we deserve. And it's soccer, no matter what it is. You know, sport is an international language, whether it's men or women playing, and getting a chance to highlight the Women's World Cup on Thursday is just going to be spectacular.
Want to start to briefly preview what we're watching for in this game. Let's start with the U.S. team. Now, I hate to be the hometown person, but let's start with that Wisconsin UW-Madison star, Rose Lavelle. Alejandra, she is on this new team. Can you talk about her role?
Yeah, definitely. Well, Rose Lavelle is obviously a big deal for us in Wisconsin. She's the midfielder for OL Reign of the National Women's Soccer League and for the United States national team. So it's so exciting to have someone from Wisconsin representing the U.S. It's super exciting. Rose Lavelle, 28, she'll be making her second appearance at the world's biggest tournament. So that's exciting. I know that she has made 88 appearances for Team USA and has 24 goals and 20 assists for the U.S. And one of her biggest goals actually came at the 2019 Women's World Cup when she gave the U.S. a 2-0 lead in the gold medal match against the Netherlands to clinch the Americans' fourth World Cup title. So it's super exciting to see, again, someone like Rose Lavelle that is, you know, from Wisconsin, just, or she's from Cincinnati, mm-hmm. but the fact that she just has that connection to Wisconsin is so cool. And I also kind of wanted to add in, we also have two UWM alums that are going to be in the World Cup, Chandler McDaniel and Olivia Davies McDaniel. They are going to be a part of the Philippines national team. But again, having that Wisconsin connection, I think, is just so unique and so special to have in the FIFA World Cup.
And Montse, there are a lot of other players on the team. Who do you have your eye on the U.S. team?
I think Megan Rapinoe, of course, is going to be such a big player. I mean, she's forward and she has made almost 200 appearances and has been in two World Cups. I think if you ask anybody, even if they're not a soccer fan, they would know who she is, not just because of who she is as a soccer player, which is already incredible because of what she's done on the field, but also off of it, being a huge advocate for LGBTQ rights, racial inequality, voter rights. And I care a lot about equal rights. And I think the fact that she was the first white athlete and first female to kneel during the national anthem with Colin Kaepernick is also something of note. So I think she's done a lot for the team, and that'll be really exciting. And just to go back to the UWM players, Chandler McDaniel and Olivia Davies McDaniel, although they're not playing for Team USA, the fact that they're able to be on the Team Philippines and be the first, no team from the Philippines, either men or women, has made it to the World Cup. So we have a lot of people that we can root for. If you don't want to root for USA, hopefully they'll make it to the end. But in case they don't, the Philippines would also be a great one to root for because of these UWM players.
Montse Ricosa and Alejandro Palacios, our news anchors for Telemundo Wisconsin, here to break down what's going on with the Women's World Cup as we approach kickoff later this week. First game's Thursday, first U.S. game on Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you going to watch? What questions do you have for our guests about this year's World Cup lineup? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation about the Women's World Cup. It kicks off later this week in Australia and New Zealand. Alejandro Palacios and Montse Ricosa stay with us from Telemundo, Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you planning to attend or host a World Cup watch party? Do you play soccer? Have kids who play? Were past World Cups an inspiration for you or your kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Some venues around the state will share the games with their customers. Brett Best joins us now, owner of a bar and restaurant in Madison called Sweet Home Wisconsin. Brett, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, I understand you're not exactly a sports bar typically, but you've got an interest in soccer. You're planning to focus in on the World Cup. Why is that?
Well, selfishly, it's because soccer is my favorite sport. We do have a small following mostly from my soccer friends and the community that I'm in. But it would be wonderful to grow and have more soccer games, viewed all year long.
And so what are you planning for the World Cup? Now, we're dealing with some big time zone differences now. What is the plan for showing the games to your customers?
Yeah, that's a big issue to deal with the World Cup for the men's tournament as well. But we were able to have some earlier morning games. The plan is to be open for the games that were legally allowed to be open and selling beverages, which would definitely be the first two games, and then into the playoffs, hopefully.
Now, do you play yourself? What does soccer mean to you and your family?
I do play myself, and I feel very fortunate to still be playing. And I'm also very fortunate that I live in a soccer household. I have three kids. They all love soccer. They all play soccer. It's a top sport in our house, and there really isn't a second sport anywhere close to it.
And do you get a sense that you're not alone in this, that you're seeing more attention to soccer than you might have seen, say, when you were growing up?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I don't know how much people love going out, going to watch parties and things like that as the larger sports. There have been plenty of bars that have offered that opportunity in Madison, but I think most of them aren't around anymore, which kind of opened the door up for me to make a push. We're not a big place, but it would certainly be a dream of mine to have soccer on all the time.
All right, Brett, thanks a lot, and I hope you enjoy the World Cup and have some lively watch parties.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Brett Best. He owns Sweet Home Wisconsin, talking about his soccer watch parties. Now we'll go back to our guests, Alejandro Palacios and Montse Ricosa from Telemundo, Wisconsin. Something I wanted to ask about, Montse, a community very interested in Wisconsin in the games, the Latino community. Can you talk about what the World Cup means?
Absolutely. I think soccer is the most popular sport because I think you can play it with just a soccer ball, which is really neat. And I think for Latinos, watching, you know, the men's World Cup just recently, there was such a huge support. I am with all of the Latin teams. I would be rooting for Team Mexico if they were here. Unfortunately, they're not. So I'll be rooting for Team USA. But I think having the opportunity to see everybody get behind a sport that traditionally, I think a lot of Latinos typically play, or at least my family has, I'm coming from Mexico, that was the sport that my family watched. So seeing some of my CBS coworkers that do come from the United States cheer on some of our teams and seeing everybody just root behind, your country is something that's really special. So getting a chance to see this all, of course, on Telemundo Wisconsin is really cool because even if you don't speak Spanish, you can still understand the golazo. Everybody knows what that is. So everybody can get behind just yelling goal together.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Green Bay. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I used to coach youth soccer. Both of my kids played. Some of my grandchildren play. And when you were talking about Megan Rapinoe, she is a goddess among us. Not just for her soccer skills, but for her human rights efforts. She doesn't discriminate. And I think that's a wonderful thing and something that our world needs more of. And I would like to say that my mom was born in 1920, my dad in 1918, and they would have absolutely adored her. So, and that's it.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Alejandra, are players like Megan Rapinoe who are getting that kind of star status in the U.S., do you see them inspiring new generations potentially of soccer players and soccer fans?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, Megan Rapinoe has just made such an impact in women's soccer throughout her 17 years. I mean, playing for the USA team. And, you know, what I love about her, like our caller mentioned, is just she's not only great, like on the field, but outside of the field, you know, all of her efforts that she has done to fight for the LGBTQ community, equal pay for the women's soccer team. I mean, she has just made such an impact that I think even though she's retiring, this won't be the last time we'll hear of her. I mean, she is just going to go on to do, you know, great things, continue to share her important messages. And I think people like her are the reason why, you know, little girls that watch soccer are like, hey, like that could be me. That could be me one day. You know, if she can do it, then I can do it. So inspirational people like that in women's soccer just are such an inspiration, I think, for the younger generation for sure.
Lisa, thanks for that. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alejandra Palacios and Mose Ricosa from Telemundo, Wisconsin and CBS 58, previewing the World Cup. The Women's World Cup kicks off in a couple days. Let's check out the field now. U.S., the team to beat, but it is not a slam dunk. or hat trick, I guess. Bonse, what teams are you watching for? What are some of the other top competitors?
Well, I think Team USA, of course, is the favorite, trying to get the three-peat. If they could, I think that would just be incredible. In terms of Latin American teams, of course, you had to limit it down to only those 32 teams. So I think, of course, USA would be a great one. The starting teams would be New Zealand. Of course, being their home countries, I think that would be a really fun one. Argentina, just because they're from Latin America, I have to team, you know, root on my other Latinos, or Panama. We have a coworker who's from there. So I think those would be my big ones. But being here, USA, we have to go all the way.
And Alejandra, how about European teams? I know there's a few heavyweights there that people are watching.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I agree with Monse. I'll definitely be rooting for Team USA, but you also got to root for the other Latin American teams that are going to be playing. So got to keep an eye out for them. Like Monse mentioned, Panama is a great example of that. There's New Zealand, there's England, there's Spain, France, Canada. I mean, there's a lot of good competition out there that the U.S. is going to have, you know, a tough battle. So they got to definitely give it their all. But nonetheless, it's going to be just such an exciting World Cup to see. I mean, the fact that they are calling this, you know, just the biggest FIFA Women's World Cup in history, with the amount of tickets that have been sold, over 1 million tickets have been sold. So I just love seeing all the attention and all the support that the Women's FIFA World Cup is getting.
Back to our callers. Tom is with us in De Pere. Hi, Tom.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think as Americans learn more about the game and, you know, what's involved, my daughter-in-law's sister married a guy who played professional soccer in Europe, and he has taught our whole family about strategy, about setting up plays and everything else, that we actually have soccer watching parties and we don't care who's playing. It's just fun to watch once you start to learn more about the game.
Well, Tom, this was right in your backyard. Did you make it to the big game at Lambeau?
No, I did not. Unfortunately, I had a fishing trip, and that does.
Oh, that's good too.
For everything.
Well, hope that storm didn't hurt your fishing trip. Tom, thanks a lot for calling in. Monse, I got to say, I'm right there with Tom in that, you know, I didn't know from soccer. I didn't get it. My kids started playing. I started watching it on TV with them. Now one of them plays in college. One of them plays club in college. A lot of Americans are slowly but surely learning how the game works, and that's making it more interesting for people, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, that one of the top sports in the United States might be football or baseball, but because soccer is such a worldwide sport, and we're seeing just more media attention on it, especially more media attention on the Women's World Cup, I think more people will start to watch it. And especially as those bars, like Brett was mentioning, start to show these. You saw a lot for the Men's World Cup open up at the crack of dawn and stay super late. And, you know, Washington, D.C. has now authorized a 24-hour bars can stay open, so you get a chance to watch these games. So I think the more attention we pay to it would be a great chance. And little by little, you know, if you just learn how to score a goal and then offsides might be a little confusing. Little by little, we can all really become big fans.
And Alejandra, this is a big event. You both have mentioned a lot of tickets sold here. Do you think this is going to help generate the next generation of soccer players, maybe young girls and boys, as this game gets a lot of attention?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the fact that this Women's World Cup is, you know, getting so much attention and just breaking a lot of those milestones when it comes to, you know, the pay for the women and just all the advertisement and attention we're seeing. I mean, I even saw that Netflix is actually going to be working with the U.S. women's team to kind of get them in the action of being at the FIFA. So getting all that attention from all these other, you know, big companies like Netflix, other channels, I mean, it's definitely going to make a big difference. And especially too for the Latino community, I mean, all the coverage that Telemundo is going to be offering for the Latino community, it's going to be nonstop coverage on Telemundo from all our programming, you know, kind of teasing the behind the scenes, the stats afterwards. So there's a lot of coverage and a lot of effort and a lot more women being involved too, which is so nice to see. They, I think, said that it's like a record of women sports commentators that are also going to be a part of this FIFA World Cup coverage for Telemundo. So that's also just very exciting to hear. So I think the more attention and support we see moving forward, I think we'll definitely get to, you know, women's soccer just continuing to grow and hopefully getting the equal rights and pay that they deserve, because they do work so hard to get to this point, you know?
We'll leave it there. Alejandra Edmondse, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Go Team USA.
That's Alejandra Palacios and Monse Ricosa, bilingual news anchors at Telemundo, Wisconsin. They join us for a preview of the Women's World Cup. The soccer tournament kicks off Thursday. The U.S. has its first game on Friday at 8 p.m. Central. Coming up after the news, a congressional defense reporter joins us for a look into the U.S. House's nearly $900 billion military budget plan, how Democrats and Republicans are reacting, and some controversial items that look like they may be big sticking points when it comes over to the U.S. Senate and to the White House. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.